Welcome to the panelists. Thank you so much for coming. This second panel is on the media, and the question we're going to be addressing is, what is the role of the media in improving Western Muslim world relations? And we have a distinguished, stellar panel here, people who've been in the forefront in terms of this battle on this new war front. So without further ado, I'll just read their bios and some brief information about them, and we'll get started. Joe Loria is a journalist who has covered international affairs at the United Nations for the Boston Globe, the London Daily Telegraph, the Montreal Gazette, and other publications. He's also an award-winning investigative reporter for the Sunday Times of London. Reverend Dr. Raymond Whitley is the author of Get Up Off Your Knees, Preaching the U2 Catalog. She's vicar of Trinity Episcopal Old Sweets Church in Sweetsboro, New Jersey. A native of Australia with a father from Belfast, she has a PhD in homiletics from Princeton Theological Seminary and has had a number of articles and sermons published. A particular area of interest is preaching and Gen Xers, about which she has written and taught. She grew up hearing her brother's U2 records playing and recently rediscovered their music. It has become a favorite source of reflection for sermons and teaching. Laura Bagneto is UN correspondent for the Saudi Press Agency and a writer in New York City who covers issues of human rights in the UN for other publications such as We News. Masood Heather is currently the president of the United Nations Correspondents Association, UNCA. He's also the UN correspondent for The Dawn, a daily with the largest circulation among English language newspapers in Pakistan. It is published simultaneously from Karachi, Lahore, and Islamabad. Mr. Heather started his journalistic career in 1970 as a correspondent for the Eastern News Agency, the first East Pakistani news agency. After INA closed its operations, he moved on to the Morning News as a reporter until 1978, when he moved to the United States. In 1984, Mr. Heather became chief editor of the South Asian ethnic newspaper Eastern Times, which was published in New York. From 88 to 89, he worked for The Muslim, Islamabad, and the following year for The Frontier Post. In 1993, he joined The Dawn, Pakistan. Abdul Qadir Abadi is currently UN correspondent for The Independent in New York. He is formerly the director of the Department of Political Affairs and deputy director of Security Council Affairs at the United Nations. He has also served as senior diplomatic correspondent of the World Observer. And I guess without further ado, we're just going to go, if all of you could just for 7 minutes speak about the topic and about the role of media in improving the Western Muslim world relations. And I guess we'll start with Joe. That's all right. Great. Okay. Thank you.
How do you do? Thank you. I want to thank the organizers for inviting me. I'm a graduate of CUNY, City College of New York, CCNY. I've also taught journalism at the Workers Education Program downtown. It's the first time I'm in this building. I wasn't here even when you can come and buy clothing at Lord & Taylor. It's quite a nice building. I'm afraid that I don't have any solutions to offer today. I mean, I have a couple of ideas, but I don't think they're going to work. But I'll throw them out there. But I could talk a long time about the problem. Not the answer. The question is, what is the role of media in improving Western Muslim relations? I think I'm more likely going to speak about what is the role of the media in destroying Western Muslim world relations. And you could take it from there. To say a good thing about the American press, before I get on to my real topic, it's pretty good on domestic reporting. Americans criticize other Americans. When Americans are behaving here on U.S. soil. I guess you'll see good local reporting of corruption in local councils. You even see reporting of corruption in Washington. And there's so many examples coming out now. The most shining one probably is still Watergate, brought down a president. And that was essentially a domestic story. It wasn't Nixon's foreign policy, secret bombing of Cambodia that was being reported. It was his spying on the Democratic National Committee and his dirty tricks to get reelected. So it was a domestic story. Even Vietnam, when the press started to turn against Vietnam, it was essentially a domestic story because of the demonstrations that began here. It started being covered that way, I think. And then the Pentagon Papers shone a light on the foreign policy. But unfortunately, now that I've said what I wanted to say, which is good about the U.S. press, I have to say that unfortunately the same really can't be said about foreign news and the coverage of foreign news and the reporting by foreign correspondents of the United States press. I think the problem is cultural as much as political. And many reporters who go abroad don't know the language of the country they're covering. They've maybe never been there before. They've read a few books before they get out there. And then they wind up at the U.S. Embassy. And they stay at the U.S. Embassy. And they call the U.S. Embassy. And they go to cocktail parties at the U.S. Embassy. And maybe, even when there's not a war going on, they might go out in the street. But I was recently at a press conference or a conference with Robert Fisk, the Independent of London's reporter, and who's been a longtime Middle East correspondent. I'm sure a lot of you know him and know about his work. And he's taken the view that you have to get out and be amongst the people of the country you're covering, actually do a good job. But a student stood up there and asked him, isn't there a problem with going native? Frankly, I really don't know exactly what that means. If it means that you go to a country, a foreign country to live in, and suddenly you've forgotten which country you come from, what your culture is, and you pretend that you're one of them, then that's probably a pretty stupid thing to do. But if it means, and I think he meant, that you actually go out there and put yourself in other people's shoes, if you actually try to see, as part of your reporting, try to see how their own country is seen by the people who live there, and then how your own government, in this case the United States' government, is perceived by the people of that country, you might actually do a pretty good job, or a better job, than is normally done. It's a pretty basic thing about journalism that you learn in high school, that there is, in high school journalism, which seems to be forgotten by highly paid foreign correspondents, is there's two sides to every story. It's not just the U.S. Embassy side of the story. And there's so many examples. I wonder if I have more time left, and I think Masood told me he'll yield 3 or 4 minutes of his time.
I yield means.
I've been reading a chapter from this book, The U.S. Press in Iran, about how the U.S. covered how the American press covered the U.S.-backed coup that overthrew Mohammad Mossadegh, the democratically elected president of Iran. But before I get to that, I want to talk a little bit more about why I think this happens. I think it's cultural. There's a cultural encapsulation. It's hard to put yourself in other people's shoes. It's hard to break out of that, but it's necessary. It's also hard because in all countries, people are inculcated in, from grammar school up, with certain myths about their country and about usually their, you know, how great their particular country is and how bad everybody else is. And in America, we learned this more, as much or more than anyone, given the enormous power the country has. So we are taught that we are the best country in the world for everything. Certainly we're a democracy, and the rest of the world needs our help in spreading that democracy. And if it takes force of arms or a coup, you know, then that's what it takes. Of course, there's no economic interests or strategic interests. It's convenient how the political reporting is in one section of the newspaper, and then throw that away, and then you've got a business section. As if the two never, ever meet. There is no political economy in the newspapers and the American press. They're two separate things. So we are motivated by democracy, by spreading democracy. But if you open the business section, you might find out about something else. But there's no connection. And I think that political reporters generally don't make that connection. I happen to cover business as well as politics, and I like that. I don't find covering business as thrilling as covering the UN, but I really am happy that I do that, because I can understand better how the two meet. And I think a guy like Ken Lay, who rest his soul, is a good example. He spent most of his time playing golf and going to the White House and giving a lot of campaign contributions to the Republicans and Democrats, and giving the Enron plane to Governor Bush when he was running for president, and giving the Enron plane to James Baker and the other lawyers when they flew to Florida to seal the election. Is that how many minutes I have left? Left? What about the time he's... Okay. So I'm not going to be able to go into this Iran. I just recommend this book, U.S. Iran, the U.S. Press and Iran. I guess I'll say a few things about it quickly. But... the issue is patriotism, too. A lot of people, reporters, are frightened. It's not unpatriotic to bring down a president if he's cheated against Americans. But if Americans are raping and pillaging foreigners, well, can't say that. Can't report that. It's patriotism. The banking stories are good. Even there, you know, this is the U.S. doing something in the war against terror that the New York Times has now revealed, and there are calls for the prosecution of the New York Times on the banking details, the Belgian Swift story. And it's the patriotism, fear of being unpatriotic. The ambassador in Iran at the time, the U.S. ambassador, criticized the New York Times reporter who was writing slightly critical stories of the Shah after the overthrow for being unpatriotic. So there's a long history of that. And I think that in order to, again, understand, let's say, how North Korea feels or how the Iranians feel, you have to put yourself in their shoes and show that both Iran and North Korea are surrounded by countries with nuclear weapons, Russia and China and Korea, Israel, Russia, again, the United States with offshore with cruise missiles that could easily be fitted with nukes. There's reasons why they feel the way they do, and they are frightened of the United States. They've also noticed a neighbor was invaded a couple of years ago. They could be next. So when you leave that out of the equation, you're not telling the full story. You're just not. And what you get then in this patriotism is a kind of garbage, frightening jingoism of outlets like CNN, where you had a reporter, Kira Phillips, standing on an aircraft carrier, a live shot of a cruise missile being fired, and she is saying, "Welcome to shock and awe." That, to me, was rock bottom of the entire awful coverage of all the cable networks and much of the printed press. Welcome to shock and awe. Some human beings are at the other side of wherever that cruise missile landed. The only way to overcome this is, and I said there's no solution, is to try to empty yourself of the prejudices you've been taught and do what you can. But even I'm sure there are a lot of good reporters out there who are able to do that. Instead of getting over the we, I've heard reporters at the UN, I know reporters talk about we when they talk to UN officials. They'll talk about we, meaning the United States. Well, it's not we. It's, you should always refer to it as the United States, even if you're an American. It's the United States against Iran. United States, you are not we. You're not an American then. You are supposed to be an independent, objective reporter, but you just don't see that. And editors will not print your stuff, even if you break through all these problems I'm saying. And a good example is the reporter for the New York Times in Iran found out about the fact that the CIA was involved in the coup overthrowing Mossadegh, and that Iranian people remember very clearly, and they're angry. And the hypocrisy of saying we want to bring democracy to Iran, the United States wants to bring democracy to Iran, when there was a democracy there and the U.S. overthrew it. When the New York Times reporter found out about it in 1954, he wrote three times in a letter to the foreign editor back here in New York, and it was just ignored. It was totally ignored. It only came out in a Saturday Evening Post story in 1955, I believe, but nobody else picked it up. And then finally in 2000, nearly 50 years later, Madeleine Albright gave a speech in which she apologized for the CIA's role, led by Kermit Roosevelt, the grandson of Teddy Roosevelt, helped by Norman Schwarzkopf's father. She acknowledged in 2000, apologized to the Iranian people, and then the Times later that year did a long story. It took them 47 years to cover that story. A little late. I think they missed that one. It's just amazing. So I'm going to stop there. I think I've probably run out of my time, haven't I? Yes. I appreciate that. Maybe in the answers, the question and answer, I can get a little more detail about what happened with Mossadegh, because I think it's important.
Who's ringing the bell? Who's the lady up here is ringing the bell?
Okay. Yeah, we have to keep a watchful eye for Kira here. We're going to have to keep out an eye for Kira.
Yeah,
okay, great. Thank you so much, Joe, for that. And Reverend...
It's good to be here with you. I guess I'm the odd one out on this panel. I'm not a journalist, though I've been interviewed by a few in my time. But I do spend a lot of my time trying to use words to influence people. The reach of those words is fairly small, about 60 or so people on a Sunday morning in my church and a few more on the website, occasionally a couple of hundred if I get invited to preach somewhere. Preaching is a kind of media, but it's not what most people think of when they talk about the media. And you probably didn't come here today to listen to a sermon. So I'm not going to do that. But what got me invited here was the book I co-edited called Get Up Off Your Knees. It's a book of sermons that draw on the lyrics of U2's songs. And the reason that Beth, the other editor, and I fought with the publisher for that title is that we're convinced that faith is no good at all unless it makes a difference. Prayer is well and good, but faith is about how you live your life, not just what you think and believe. My job is to make connections between what people think and what they actually do in their lives. And one place I see that happening, one place where I see connections between our thoughts and our lives, is in pop culture. It happened with Live Aid back in the 80s, when a bunch of bands came together and raised what seemed like a huge amount of money at the time, though we know it was just a drop in the bucket, to help out people in extreme poverty. 20 years later, and Live Aid gathered people across the world to text their support for G8 governments to take action on international debt. Pop culture, music and TV and the internet have enormous power to influence what we think, our values, the choices we make. The impact of music in particular has increased dramatically with the advent of the iPod. Where once TV was probably the dominant force in pop culture, music has regained its preeminence because we can take it wherever we go. Most of us listen to a whole lot more music than we watch TV. At the same time, we've seen the reemergence of bands who are politically active, something that was kind of around in the 60s before you all and I was born. But those bands are urging us to change. We hear music about peace, about environmentalism, about war. The music doesn't just entertain us, it tries to convert us. Music can express things that we want to say but can't quite find the words. What got me started on the whole YouTube preaching thing was in 2001, as every Sunday I read the names of 42 people in my diocese who died on 9/11. And I heard that lament of the song Peace on Earth with its lists of names of people who died in the Omagh bombings in Ireland. I'm half Irish. I know the cost of war. You two gave me the words that I needed to say. And because music is something that we share with other fans, it forms us in a community. We discover we have something in common with people who are different from us. It forms a bond between us. Music can become the basis of relationships, can help us build bridges. And if the bands have their way, music will also move us to action. We'll text our support for the One campaign, we'll join Amnesty, we will perhaps, maybe even lay down our guns. When I'm faced with the topic today of how media, and particularly unconventional media, can influence US-Muslim relations, I remember those three things. Music can give us common language. Music can build bridges. Music can move us to action. When I listen to music, whether it's you two or something else, I have something in common with all the other fans. It doesn't matter where we were born, what colour our skin is, who we believe in. We have something in common. Maybe I can find music that I share with my Muslim brothers and sisters that will become the basis of a shared language. Music that will help us talk about the things that we care for most deeply, help us understand who we are. Maybe that music will become the basis of a conversation. Conversation that grows beyond the music itself into a relationship that takes us on a journey from enmity to friendship. And maybe if I hear the words, we need love and peace, love, love and peace, lay down your guns, all you daughters of Zion, all your Abraham's sons, maybe I'll find the courage myself to begin the work of peace. To find ways to help my brothers and sisters, Christian and Muslim, American and Iraqi and Afghan and British, to lay down our guns, to build relationships, to work for peace. But I have no illusions. Even leaving aside the issue of music that tries to convert its listeners to hate, and there's plenty of that around too, even leaving that aside, great music doesn't ensure changed lives. Yesterday I read a story online that showed the gap between the euphoria and enthusiasm of a U2 concert and what goes on when people go home. The writer was in a train along with a bunch of other fans travelling home after a U2 concert in this last tour. A Muslim woman came through a carriage and the U2 fans who had just sung about love and peace, who'd just seen the Declaration of Human Rights projected over their heads, had just watched Bono with the word coexist written with crescent star and cross around his head. Those same fans harassed this woman, threatening her, accusing her of being a terrorist. They'd heard the words, perhaps even sung along and texted their support for one, but it never changed their lives. It's up to us. Will we live out what we believe? Will we actually take action? Or will we just sing along? Thank you.
Thank you so much, Reverend Laura. If you could please, thank you.
Thank you so much for inviting me here. I think that you should also thank the Security Council, at least for the four of us, because they decided not to meet on North Korea today, thank God. So, what is the role of media in improving Western-Muslim relations? My presence here as the United Nations correspondent for the Saudi Press Agency and as an American citizen reporting for an Arab and for all intents and purposes, Muslim wire service, is one example of how the us-them Western-Muslim divide is narrowing. Or perhaps it would be more correct to say that the differences in the two cultures are at least being recognized. That said, let's take a look at what the U.S. government is doing. The State Department frequently invites Arab journalists, many of them my colleagues at the UN, to go on friendly press junkets to Michigan, which has a large Muslim population, and to other states for various events that Muslim and Arab readers would be interested in. And from my individual experience at the UN, the Secretariat works with the State Department in bringing Palestinian journalists over to show them, as one I met put it with a wry smile, for us to see that we are not forgotten. I had an exchange of ideas with a group of Palestinian journalists who were surprised when I told them I write about the Palestinian occupied territories almost every day as it pertains to the UN, and so do most, if not all, of my Arab colleagues, whether they are reporting for Lebanese, Kuwaiti, Egyptian, Emirati, or pan-Arab television. So in a sense, even an exchange of ideas between journalists, Western and Muslim, is a positive aspect of the U.S. government programs. So let's look at what the United States is doing in order to win hearts and minds in the Arab-Muslim world. Two American backventures, and forgive my Arabic pronunciation, the satellite TV channel Al Hurra, the free one, and Radio Sawa, or Together in Arabic jargon, were launched to great acclaim, but have failed to play a major role in improving relations. Al Hurra, launched on Valentine's Day, ironically, 2004, meant well, but lost the message somewhere. First of all, Al Hurra has come under criticism for its name alone. The free one, according to one media critic, is America looking down on you, the Arab people, saying that we are free and you are not. Not a good start. Even its mission statement reeks of condescension. And to give you some sort of a comparison, I'll read you a statement from another media outlet. I quote, "Our mission is to be the essential global news network, providing distinctive news services of the highest quality, reliability, and objectivity with reports that are accurate, balanced, and informed. Compare that to, we endeavor to broaden its viewers' perspectives, enabling them to make more informed decisions." Really? Thanks. The previous mission statement was from Associated Press, the wire service, available for free on their website. Certainly AP looks to broaden viewers' perspectives and give them the information to make informed decisions. But when you are talking about bridging a great cultural, religious, and ethnic divide, you have to be more attuned to nuances. Even accents make a difference. In order to improve Western-Muslim relations, you have to understand your target audience and employ effective salespeople. It is well documented that Al Hurra's 300-plus staff, most of them hail from Lebanon, which is indeed part of the Arab world, but Al Hurra's Lebanese staff contains a majority of Maronite Christians. There are more Josephs than Muhammads on staff, in fact. Al Hurra didn't even interview much less hire Arabic-speaking Americans who know the product they are trying to sell, who understand American values. Instead, they brought Arabs over from Lebanon and other parts of the Middle East who are not familiar with their product. Throughout the Arab-Muslim world, soccer is considered the most popular sport. I wish it was here. Go Italy! Yet during New Year's celebrations, Al Hurra chose not to run a New Year's theme program like the other stations in the region, but broadcast an NBA basketball game instead. And basketball, by the way, is the most popular sport in Lebanon, not soccer. Claude Salhani, the international editor at United Press International, or UPI, a newswire, focused on another editorial decision that prevented Al-Hurra from being taken seriously. What we see now in those new U.S. government networks is like a bicycle without its training wheels. They're programming cooking shows and documentaries on monkeys during the fighting in Fallujah in Iraq and Rafah in Gaza. So what needs to be done here? According to critiques here and abroad, Al-Hurra and Radio Sawa need to win back some credibility. The first step would be to hire a top TV manager from the U.S. who can convey American values and ideas in a non-condescending, non-threatening way. And this person would absolutely need to be paired with a native Arab speaker who understands American society, but his or own society as well, to prevent basketball gaffes and to tailor programming to those who are watching it, not to those who are creating the programs. And let's face it, competition is good. It creates higher standards and encourages more tailored reporting. Imagine if you could only read the New York Times here in New York, or the New York Sun, or, God forbid, the New York Post. Al Jazeera, the most popular Arab satellite station throughout the world, and Al Arabiya, the second most popular, could do with some competition. Perhaps if Rumsfeld put his money where his mouth is, although I'm not sure he could do that in a subtle way, the Arab perception of the United States would be a little less harsh. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Laura. Masood Heather, please.
Yeah, my name is Masood Heather. I work for, I've been living in the United States for almost 28 years. And first of all, I'd just like to build a perspective before actually trying to assess as to what the media has done to either improve or disprove the relations between the Muslim community and the Western world. And first of all, let me thank the organizers for allowing me to come here. Immediately after the 9/11 attacks, I was invited to Long Island, to Southampton, Long Island, by a group of ladies who wanted to actually get the hang of it as to why this happened. And when I went there, they all looked at me, and the first question, I mean, it is not, what everybody said, that this is a stereotype. No. The first thing they said to me, why do you hate us so much? And I just turned around and I said, no, actually, we don't hate you so much. You must understand. You must understand as to when the Osama bin Ladens and all these so-called jihadists were being employed by the U.S. Army and the CIA. Osama bin Laden was carried by CIA from Jeddah, from Riyadh, into Afghanistan. Nobody believed me. We can't believe. I said, look at read the New York Times. After I referred to New York Times, they start to believe me. And then at that particular meeting, somebody got up. He said, I don't care what everybody else is saying. I want you to leave this country right now. We hate you because you hate us. And I'll tell you another thing that happened. Immediately, as soon as this gentleman got up, somebody else got up and said, I disagree with you. I will not allow this man to leave here because a bigot like you is asking him to leave. So that is basically what I'm saying. So, and the thing is that the American public has not been able to absorb so many things that have happened in order to clarify that it is not the so-called Muslim world which completely hates the Christian or the Western world. It's just some of the jihadists who were created as a consequence of American war, especially in Afghanistan, in order to beat the Red Machine. When I say we, I mean the United States funded all these fundamentalists who then turn around and attack the United States. And then this particular aspect that what is being perpetuated by the media is that Muslims are bad. Now look at this just now, an example of these terrorist suspects arrested in Miami. That they were about to blow up the Chicago Towers. Now it finally, and that they were connected to Al-Qaeda. They were not. Actually, finally it turned out that those suspects were part of a brotherhood called Seas of David. The members of this group described themselves as soldiers because, according to them, we study and we train through the Bible, not only physically and mentally. And this group also worshipped in a temple, not in a mosque. But to this day, everybody believes that they were Muslims, belonged to Al-Qaeda, and they were sympathetic. They were about to attack the Chicago Towers. That particular aspect is not dispelled as yet. And then, does anybody over here remember that last week, last Monday, that in Maine, in a small town in Maine, which is called Lewiston in Maine, there were about 40 Muslims praying in a grave, and suddenly a pig's head was thrown into the midst of the prayer. And the Muslim, of course, is totally shocked with this. And when police finally arrested the man, he said, "Oh, no, no, what are you talking about? It's just a joke. Can't you just take a joke?" As far as that particular incident, the throwing of a pig in a mosque is equal to like throwing a pig's in a synagogue, or in the sense of painting of these swastikas over the Jewish temples. It's just absolutely abhorrible. But nobody took notice of it, and nobody tried to reach out and say that, okay, this was wrong, we should do something about it. The Muslim community over there is now trying, which is essentially Muslim community over there is comprises of like 2,000 Somalians who have come there from Somalia. So does anybody know that this happened? Did the media tell you this happened? Yeah, some of us, yes. So what basically I believe that the media in the United States, I think one thing that I must concede, the New York Times, no matter how much people like it or dislike it, I don't know, New York Times is making an effort to involve the Americans in a dialogue. It is doing that over and over again by interviewing various Muslim leaders, and recently they had a very good article about these Muslim comedians. Well, there was this one Muslim comedian who went off to say that, listen, he has a beard, he's 6 foot tall, and he wears some sort of a turban. As soon as he walks into the airplane, he says, everybody looks at me and they seem to say that we are surely going to heaven. over there, the New York Times builds that story and says that, listen, people are being sensitized by these, comedians and so forth. So I believe New York Times is doing a good job. But the media in the United States, what it needs to do is to inform the people over here about what it is, and that is festering in the Muslim world. And the number one problem which they have not been able to address or been able to sink in the people of the United States is that the issue of Palestine is the one issue which is absolutely responsible for the relationship between the Western world and the Muslims being totally marred. This problem of Palestine, which has been festering forever, needs to be resolved. If it is not resolved, the Muslims will continue to feel undermined, and that the Muslim cause. There has to be an even-handed approach by the United States in somehow asking Israel to come to the table and resolve this matter, because the policies of Israel at this time are so heavy-handed and outrageous that it will continue to undermine the relations between the Muslim world and the Western world. And that is one of the bottom line over here. Thank you. I'll have to stop here because my time is almost over.
Thank you very much, Masood. And last but not least, we'll have Mr. Abadi. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Who in their right mind will come on a beautiful Saturday afternoon to listen to journalists instead of being on the beach or walking in the gardens and parks? But it shows something. You are committed young ladies and young boy people, and you must be commended. I also wish to thank the leaders of this organization, Young Global Leaders, for inviting us here to make a few remarks to you. After my distinguished colleague spoke, there is nothing left for me to say. So I'm going to try anyway. The role of the media in improving Western Muslim world relations. This is extremely important question, and I think it goes, and that will be my thesis here. It should go beyond journalism. It is extremely important because it has not been discussed enough, and nothing has been done enough about it at the global level. So the question implies that the relationship is not that good, and it is not. At the present time, it is not. Why, then, this relationship is not good? Well, several reasons that you all know, historical as well as current. I only can make a list of them. Colonialism, occupation by the West, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, Hamdaniya, the latest. Profiling, issues of visas, difficult life for Muslim communities in the U.S. Books and articles written on Prophet Muhammad, depicting him in negative terms, leading to a rage in several Muslim countries. How do we know the relationship is not that good? Well, ask Karen Hughes. You know all. Ask Secretary of State Rice, and you will know. Ask Andrew Court, the director of the Pew Research Center. And they have done research about this very same question and published a report on it. You might be interested in that, those of you who want to pursue the subject. On June 22nd, New York Times article, I have a few copies for you here, polls, this is the title, polls find discord between the Muslim and Western worlds, and they give the statistic about that. So, the grievances are not all on one side. The West is doing good things vis-à-vis the Muslims and at the same time has grievances. Western countries are helping many Muslim countries in various fields such as development and education. They intervened in Bosnia to save Muslims from killing. They say Islamist terrorists are not fought by Muslims. They say imams preach intolerance and hatred. They say women are not well treated in Muslim countries. What can the media do then to improve the relationship? Well, by simply following the values that they should follow. Being objective, independent, showing integrity. We have had non-examples of these that you might know, such as Walter Cronkite, such as James Resson of New York Times, Ed Murrow, you have seen the film. Those are in these traditions. Maybe journalists should take a note and practice the values like doctors with the Hippocrates oath. They should subscribe to an ethical code. We have already some organizations that are watchdogs on journalism, such as fairness and accuracy in reporting. All this is important. Bad journalists should be familiar, and this is the linking thread between all of us, with the culture. The question asked goes beyond the media and media role. It really touches on cultures and civilizations. There is a great deal of misunderstanding between these two worlds, the Muslim and Western worlds. The fight against terrorism, legitimate as it is, has made Muslim communities feel they are insecure. Suspicion and misunderstanding is growing, and the gulf between the two communities is also growing. This is accentuated by those who write about the negative aspect of the relationship. You know the book that has been recently published, Why They Hate Us, to which Muslims answer, This is Islamophobia. Just before coming here, I was listening to a report on the radio, one of the local stations, and a former official of the New York City was saying, talking about the Islamists, saying we now have a war of civilization. I beg to differ with that concept. The most important task in this area, therefore, I believe, is to prevent this gap from widening with the risk of becoming a cultural conflict. So what do we do? Journalists in the West should engage their counterpart in the Muslim world. They should hold an annual global forum, and maybe Anka can initiate that. People of faith should begin the dialogue among themselves. People of moral vision should help in the process. We now have an alliance of civilization, a global organization set up by UN Secretary Kofi Annan just a few months ago, and they have just begun to meet. It is time to engage and to dialogue. This is the basis of mutual understanding. And in the world, we have a special responsibility, especially young people like you, to bridge the gap between the two worlds. You are the future. We know about Western societies because we studied Shakespeare and Marc Chagall and Mark Twain and Victor Hugo and Frank Sinatra and others. But can we understand the Muslim societies if we do not know their singers and their poets and their writers and their architect and their painters? Can we really name them now here? Maybe Omar Sharif only. This is a challenge. Thank you.